The call reached the hospital before sunrise. A 6-month-old boy arrived unresponsive, carried in by medics who moved fast but kept their faces tight. The team worked under steady alarms, each step tracked by protocol. Within minutes, the doctors saw injuries that raised a different kind of pressure. The pattern was clear. It did not point to sickness. It did not point to a fall. It carried signs that demanded a report and a full investigative response. Detectives stepped into the case as the medical team handed over early findings. The timeline of care did not match the damage. The accounts given in those first hours shifted as questions tightened. A house that had seemed quiet now held weight. From that moment, the case moved by the rules of forensic inquiry. Each detail pulled the investigation closer to the person who last held the child alive. Chapter 1, The First Hours. The emergency room lights stayed bright as the infant was moved into a treatment bay. The medics reported that he had stopped breathing at home. They described attempts to revive him during transport. The lead physician began a rapid exam. Staff noted bruising. They logged the location in clear clinical terms. The team tried to stabilize him, but it became clear that the injuries were severe. After continued efforts, the attending doctor called the time. The room went still, except for the sound of carts being pushed aside. Under New Jersey law, the hospital reported the case to law enforcement. The shift supervisor called the local precinct and used the phrasing reserved for unexplained injuries in a child. Detectives arrived before the body left the room. The doctor walked them through the findings. He pointed out the trauma pattern. It did not align with accidental compression. It did not align with a reported fall. The positioning, force indicators, and internal damage pushed the case into the category that required a full forensic inquiry. Detectives followed protocol and asked for the timeline. The mother reported that the child became unresponsive shortly after feeding. She said she noticed something wrong and called for help. She described trying to wake him. She told officers that she had cared for him through the previous night. Her tone stayed controlled, but parts of her account lacked detail. The officers recorded everything and kept their questions simple. At that stage, nothing moved beyond fact gathering. A relative who was present offered a brief statement. He said the household had been quiet. He had no knowledge of any incident that could explain the injuries. The medics added their observations from the scene. They said the environment looked calm. They noted nothing overturned or broken. Their report focused on the moment of pickup, not on speculation. Detectives wrote it into the first log. The body was transferred to the medical examiner under chain of custody. The examiner received the file and ordered a full forensic review. Detectives followed the transport to ensure that every step remained documented. In the hallway outside the exam area, one investigator spoke in a low voice. He said the injuries pointed toward inflicted trauma. The second investigator agreed, but warned that they had to wait for the official ruling. Procedure held the pace tight. Detectives then moved to the residence. The home sat on a quiet street with houses close together. A patrol unit had secured the doorway. Officers logged each person entering. The detectives took a slow walk through the kitchen and living room. They photographed surfaces. They checked for signs of an accident. Nothing suggested a fall from height or an object that could cause that level of impact. The crib looked arranged. The bedding was undisturbed. The bottle on the counter was clean and recently used. The investigators noted the temperature of the room and the condition of the floors. They searched for any medical supplies or medications that might point to a sudden health condition. They found none. They collected the infant's clothing from the prior night. They bagged it under numbered evidence tags. They checked the bathroom. They saw no sign of water overflow or slip injury. The house stood in order. The quiet pressed into the detectives as they worked. A timeline board took shape in the living room. One detective wrote the final verified time the infant had been seen alert by anyone outside the home. They added the time the mother claimed he became unresponsive. They added the call to emergency services. The gaps between the marks raised questions. Medical indicators suggested trauma that would have produced immediate distress. That detail placed pressure on the stated sequence of events. The detectives asked the relative to walk through the prior evening. He said he had been in another room. He reported no cries or loud activity. He had assumed the night passed normally. The officers marked his statement on the board and underlined it. Still, it did not answer what caused the injuries. As the scene work continued, detectives received an update from the hospital. The attending physician had completed the preliminary report. It ruled out sudden infant death. It ruled out a collapse from sickness. The trauma pattern carried clear forensic meaning. The lead detective held the phone in silence for a moment before he wrote a single line in his notebook. It became the first anchor point of the case. Back at the home, the mother repeated her earlier account. She said she woke during the night to feed the child. She said nothing unusual had occurred. Detectives kept their questions limited. At this stage, they were not permitted to confront inconsistencies. They took her words down word for word. They noted pauses. They noted where she looked away. Still, the officers kept a neutral tone. The investigation had not yet crossed into accusatory steps. As daylight moved in, the medical examiner confirmed the plan for a full autopsy. Detectives prepared a formal request for medical records. They called the prosecutor's office to notify them of a suspicious death under review. The supervisor on duty approved the next sequence of interviews. Before leaving the residence, one detective stood at the crib again. He measured the height. He checked the spacing of the bars. He ran his hand across the rail and noted no sharp edges. He stepped back and wrote a short line. The crib did not match the injury pattern. That detail tightened the case more than anything else they had seen that morning. The officers finished their walkthrough and gathered at the door. They reviewed each step of the scene. Nothing pointed to an accident. Nothing aligned with the explanation they had been given. The investigation moved forward under the weight of the injuries alone. As the detectives left, the house felt colder. The next phase would depend on what the autopsy confirmed. That ruling would decide whether the case remained a medical inquiry or advanced into a criminal investigation with a defined suspect. Chapter 2: The Turn in the Evidence. The autopsy began under controlled lights. The medical examiner worked with a steady pace and clear language for every step. Within the first phase, he confirmed what the hospital team had already suspected. The injuries were not accidental. The force markers and internal trauma aligned with inflicted harm. He documented each finding in the report and entered the cause of death as blunt force trauma. The manner of death was listed as homicide. That ruling shifted the investigation from suspicion to confirmed criminal act. Detectives received the call just after midday. The lead examiner did not soften the language. He said the pattern had no medical explanation that could remove human action. He told them the injuries would have caused immediate distress. The detectives wrote his statements in full. They knew this ruling would guide every question from that point forward. They also knew it meant the timeline provided by the caregivers had to hold against physical evidence. The investigative team reconvened at the precinct. They created a new board with the autopsy findings at the center. Around it, they placed the statements collected during the first hours. Each detail was tested against the confirmed forensic markers. The injuries would not have allowed a period of quiet or rest. They would not have allowed delayed symptoms. This meant the event happened close to the time the infant became unresponsive. Only a small number of people were present during that window. Detectives reviewed the household structure. They confirmed who lived in the home. They confirmed who had access to the child. They looked at work schedules and visitor logs. The mother, Cassia Rivera, was the primary caregiver that night. She had been the one who reported the medical emergency. She had been the last to hold the child. That did not make her guilty, but it placed her timeline under direct review. The first formal interview was scheduled with her. She sat across from two investigators in a neutral room. The audio recorder clicked on. They asked her to describe the night again. She repeated that she fed the child, laid him down, and later found him unresponsive. The detectives let her speak without interruption. When she finished, they asked about any falls. She said there had been none. They asked about any sudden noise or incident. She shook her head. The officers noted every detail. The medical examiner's report already contradicted parts of her account. The injuries were severe enough that they would have caused immediate crying or collapse. When detectives asked if she heard any distress, she said no. The contradiction became a pressure point. They did not confront her directly yet. Procedure required that they gather all statements before entering accusatory questioning. Still, the gap remained on the board for everyone to see. Detectives then interviewed relatives. One relative repeated his earlier statement that he had not heard anything unusual during the night. He said he was shocked when the mother called for help. He said the household had seemed quiet. Another person who visited the home earlier that week said the child had appeared healthy. These statements aligned with what the medical records showed. The infant had no conditions that could create sudden trauma of that severity. Toxicology results returned in the late afternoon. There were no drugs, no dangerous substances, no medical anomalies that could explain the injuries. This removed the last possible alternative explanation. The cause of death stayed anchored in direct physical force. Detectives accessed the infant's medical history with proper authorization. The records showed routine checkups with no concerns. There were no previous injuries or conditions that would confuse the analysis. This strengthened the forensic timeline. Nothing in the record could mask or mimic inflicted harm. The investigation turned fully toward the caregivers. The next interview involved individuals connected to the home but not present during the night. One person described tensions in the household. He said there had been stress around caregiving duties. He did not offer accusations, only concerns that the mother had been overwhelmed. Detectives logged it as context, not evidence. They remained cautious. Stress alone does not prove criminal action. Still, the comment added another layer to the picture forming on the board. The investigators returned to the medical examiner with follow-up questions. They asked whether the injuries could be older. The examiner said no. He stated that the trauma was recent and inflicted close to the time the child lost consciousness. They asked whether the injuries could occur from rough play. The examiner said the force required exceeded that scenario. These clarifications tightened the case further. Detectives compared every statement against this updated forensic map. The contradictions began to form a clear line. The relative had heard nothing. The mother claimed nothing unusual happened, yet the injuries would have produced immediate signs. The timeline left almost no room for another person to be involved. The circle around the primary suspect narrowed, guided not by speculation, but by the physical facts that remained unchanged from the moment the child arrived at the hospital. The investigators prepared their notes for the next stage. They organized the statements chronologically. They reviewed the autopsy details again. Each piece strengthened the pattern pointing toward the caregiver who had provided the initial explanation. The prosecutor's office received an early summary. They noted the medical ruling and the contradictions in the timeline. They advised detectives to continue gathering clarifying statements before moving forward. Before closing the day, the detectives met once more with the mother. They asked her to go through the night for a third time. Her wording shifted again. She paused in places she had not paused before. When she was asked about any pressure applied during feeding or soothing, she denied it. Her voice stayed low. The detectives wrote each answer but held back any challenge. They needed one more layer of confirmation before the case advanced. That confirmation arrived the next morning. The final autopsy documents included exact measurements of the force markers. They detailed internal injuries that aligned with a specific direction and impact strength. This information eliminated any possibility of an accidental event. It also matched no explanation offered by the caregivers. With this, the detectives had the final anchor point required to move the case forward. Chapter 3, The Break, The Charges, The Aftermath. The detectives moved into the next phase with the autopsy findings in hand. They met with the prosecutor's office early in the morning. The presentation was direct. The cause of death was blunt force trauma. The manner of death was homicide. The timing aligned with the period when only one caregiver had sustained access. The statements given by that caregiver did not match the physical evidence. The prosecutor reviewed the summary and instructed detectives to proceed with a formal confrontation. The mother, Cassia Rivera, arrived at the precinct that same afternoon. She sat in the interview room with the door closed and the recorder running. The detectives began by restating the timeline she had given. Then they shifted. They read sections of the autopsy report aloud. They listed the injuries and the medical examiner's conclusion that they could not come from a fall or sudden illness. They noted that the injuries would have produced immediate distress, contradicting her claim that the child had been calm before the collapse. She shook her head and said she did not know how the injuries happened. Her voice stayed quiet. The detectives asked again whether there had been any drop, strike, or sudden force applied. She denied each possibility. They paused and let the silence fill the room. The investigators were required to confront contradictions clearly, but without threat or speculation. They pointed to the force measurements. They pointed to the internal injuries. They stated that the explanation she had provided did not line up with the forensic facts. She did not offer a new version of events. At that point, the detectives ended the interview. Procedure required that they avoid pressing beyond the evidence already documented. They stepped out of the room and contacted the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor approved the arrest based on the confirmed medical findings and the inconsistent statements. Detectives returned to the room, informed Rivera of the charges, and placed her under arrest. The restraints clicked closed with no resistance. Rivera was charged with aggravated manslaughter and endangering the welfare of a child. These charges were allegations until resolved in court. The prosecutor's announcement noted that the case was built on medical and forensic evidence rather than confession or witness accounts. The public statement emphasized that the child's death resulted from injuries that could not occur through accident or natural cause. The language remained precise to avoid speculation. The case moved into the court system over the following months. The medical examiner's report formed the backbone of the prosecution. The timeline of events and the contradictions in the caregiver's account became central points. Defense filings challenged aspects of the forensic interpretation but did not produce an alternative explanation supported by medical evidence. The court reviewed the record and the positions presented by both sides. Rivera later entered a guilty plea to manslaughter. The plea established the criminal responsibility recognized by the court. The judge issued a sentence that reflected the severity of the child's death and the confirmed sequence of events. The judgment became part of the permanent public record. In the aftermath, the community responded with a mix of grief and disbelief. The death of an infant carried weight beyond the courtroom. Family members expressed sorrow during sentencing. They spoke about a life cut short and the questions that would never be fully answered. They listened as the court read the final terms of the plea and the sentence. Afterward, the family requested privacy. The detectives closed the case once sentencing was completed. They reviewed the file one final time. Every major step had been guided by the earliest forensic indicators. The chain of evidence had held. The medical findings had remained consistent across every stage. The contradictions in the caregiver's statements never resolved. The case had been built on the facts present from the first minutes in the hospital, and those facts had carried through to the final ruling. When the file was archived, the lead detective paused before placing it in storage. The details were clear. A child who should have been safe had died from inflicted harm. The investigation had answered the legal questions, but it could not repair the loss. Some cases end with clarity, but not closure. This was one of them.